This Texas Matters podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns. More at TechPonte.com.
From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, is the political landscape in Texas shifting blue? And will redistricting shift it back to red? And celebrating and mourning the Voting Rights Act. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The Republican Party took the majority of the Texas House of Representatives in 2003. The GOP had already won the governor and control of the Senate. The House was the last piece of the state government trifecta that's been in place ever since. Controlling all three vital centers of state power makes it much easier for the dominant party to pursue its agenda, essentially without aggressive oversight, which is not unlike how the Democrats ran Texas when they had power trifecta up until 1994. There are predictions that this election cycle could be the year that Democrats gain control of the House, but is that political puffery and wishful thinking? Is there really a chance? And what could it mean for the Dems to have some power in Texas, particularly in a redistricting session? Harvey Kronberg joins us, the founding editor of the Quorum Report, a nonpartisan online newsletter that covers Texas politics.
We saw in the midterm election a record turnout of voters. Usually the Democratic coalition of women, minorities, and other groups don't usually show up in the midterms. They do show up in presidential elections. They had 8 million people, which is about 3 million more than you would typically have in a midterm. And so the supposition is if people were so excited about voting in the midterm that we had a record number of 8 million, that we might see as many as 10 million to 11 million in this next general election. The bigger the turnout, the better, at least hypothetically, it is for Democrats. As both Democratic and Republican consultants will tell you, when you get to about 9.5 million voters in Texas, you simply run out of Republicans. Now, whether that proves to be true or not remains to be seen, but it's pretty clear that both the Democratic and Republican bases are highly motivated, and the lists of independents and undecideds has dwindled pretty significantly.
Looking at those midterm results, Texas legislature, they closed the margin, but it's still pretty red.
That was a gain of 12, if I recollect, Democrats. A gain of another 9 Democrats would give the majority to the current minority party. There's actually a total of 18 seats in which Beto O'Rourke either won in that district or lost by only 2 to 4 points. All of those seats look winnable for Democrats, presuming the antipathy towards the president continues to motivate their normal constituencies. We're expecting a large African-American turnout, obviously, a large Hispanic turnout, although I think they're less homogeneous in terms of their voting patterns. They do tend to lean Democratic. Most significantly, the suburbs are the ones which the Republicans have most have continuously relied upon. And the suburbs essentially flip. The best example is Fort Bend County, which used to be best known for Tom DeLay. They swept all the Republicans out of office. They now have a Democratic county chair. And you even have a circumstance where the Republican sheriff in Fort Bend County has announced that he's not running for re-election. And most people believe he thinks that he could be beat. He may be looking at a congressional seat instead.
So there are a lot of factors that would be going into trying to shape the reality that we wake up to on Election Day in 2020. And the Democrats know this. They know that, wow, all we need is 9 seats, and that there were 18 seats that are kind of wonky in the last election. So maybe they can pick up half of those. If they do that, there's also going to be this presidential race. It's going to be highly charged, highly toxic with the was what appears to be Donald Trump running for re-election as president, playing the race card pretty hard. That could backfire in parts of Texas. Also, there's a lot of Democrats who are waking up to the fact that they've got to start winning down ballot. It's not just the big ticket races, and they're starting to put money and emphasis into that, particularly here in Texas. So,
well, you just named something that's really a significant change, and that is money. Texas has, for the last 20 years, Texas Democrats have exported money to other states. If you're the Democratic National Committee and you're looking at a governor's race or a Senate race in Georgia, you're talking about two media markets. If you're talking about a statewide race in Texas, you're talking about more than 20 media markets, four of which are among the most expensive, in the top 10 most expensive media markets in the country. So, say $20 million would be overpowering in a state like Georgia or Wisconsin. Typically, it'd be a drop in the bucket here in Texas. So, but what's different this time, and largely goes unnoted, is that we're getting ready to have the census. The census will likely give Texas three or four additional congressional seats. If the House, the Texas House, goes Democratic, and the Texas Senate, as most of us believe, stays Republican, they are probably not likely to come up with a congressional map, which will send it to the courts. And the courts don't care about incumbency. Theoretically, they don't care about partisan advantage. And it would be, whereas the Republicans will ultimately control the legislative redistricting, they will not necessarily control congressional redistricting. And so the National Democratic Party doesn't just want to keep Donald Trump busy by having to come defend Texas and make the Republicans have to spend money to defend Texas. There is a bigger prize, and that would be a decade-long effect if all of this were to affect congressional redistricting. You add half a dozen Democratic seats from Texas, and you've changed the scorecard pretty seriously in D.C. So viable Texas candidates will not want for resources. And what that also means is that you can recruit a higher grade of candidate if you've got promise of money and organizational support.
So I'm going to go over some of that a little bit more here. Now, if the Democrats, that's a big if, and we've seen this if floating around for a long time. So if the Democrats somehow win control of the Texas House, then they're able to play a role in drawing up the maps for the next decade. There's still a lot of going on there that they don't have control over. First of all, you know, there's still Greg Abbott, and there's still the Senate. If this gets gridlocked and they can't come up with a map that everyone can agree on, like you said, the congressional map goes to the federal courts, but the legislative map will go to this commission that they have, the Legislative Redistricting Board.
Correct.
And that's made up of the lieutenant governor, the comptroller, the land commissioner, the speaker, and the attorney general. And so they're going to draw these maps, and they're going to put things in a way that these are Republicans. They're mainly going to be, you know, four out of five probably will be Republicans, or if not five out of five.
No, the Legislative Redistricting Board has no role in congressional redistricting. But legislatively, it virtually guarantees that the Republicans will regain control of the House in the subsequent election.
Yeah, they're going to draw the maps for Texas House, Texas Senate, and they're able to do it as aggressively as they want because the courts are not going to get involved.
There's still a prohibition against racial gerrymandering, but the court has walked away from trying to prevent partisan gerrymandering. So as long as there are certain minimum thresholds that they meet in terms of racial and ethnic diversity, the map will probably stand. And we should recall that in this last redistricting, the overwhelming growth in population in the state of Texas was Hispanic, and yet they only ended up with one additional Hispanic congressional seat. So it's with the power of modern computing, even though the state is probably, well, Houston's the most diverse city in the country right now. And if you go to Collin County, just outside of Dallas County, once one of the most Republican strongholds, you'll find that it's a very diverse ethnic mix. And typically in a redistricting, at the beginning of redistricting, the party that draws the map prevails, and then it starts degrading by the end of the decade. But with the growth in ethnic and minority populations and the current disdain of college-educated women with the Republican Party, it still may be very difficult to draw a majority for the Texas House.
If the Democrats are able to win control of the House, the prize ain't that great.
It's not coincidental that it's the last election of the old redistricting map in which the Democrats may end up prevailing. But with the speed with which the state is transforming itself ethnically, some people believe that within two elections after this next redistricting, the eggs will be so scrambled that we may end up becoming a competitive state sooner than anybody anticipated.
There's one thing you can't gerrymander. Those are statewide races.
Correct.
And so we have John Cornyn running for re-election for U.S. Senate. There are some signs that he may not be as popular as many people thought.
Well, the president handed him a gift when he endorsed him early on, thus preventing a serious primary challenge. Many of us thought that Dan Patrick would at least seriously consider going after him in the Republican primary, but once President Trump laid hands on him, he became off limits. Although the grassroots doesn't always respond to instruction from above, but in this case, it has freed him up. Cornyn's fundraising prior to this last report was actually fairly anemic. He had about $5 million in the bank before this last report. He got it up to $9 million, but it was at the essentially daily requests and solicitations by email, and it was in many ways parroting the language and phraseology of President Trump.
So he's throwing a lot of red meat out there in exactly. These fundraising asks in the emails, saying, mm-hmm. Did you see what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has done lately, this type of stuff.
Exactly. Cornyn has the particular problem of being an establishment Republican. He is not particularly polled well among Republican primary voters in non-election years, sometimes under 50%, because they see him as not sufficiently confrontational, more consensus-oriented. So he's had to sharpen the knife, obviously, coming into the election. And he has been raising the specter of Pelosi and Schumer, and for a while it looked like he was going to be running against Beto. He was doing his best to get the Republican base engaged and inflamed. In this reporting period, he got up to about $9 million in the bank, which is still not a huge amount of money for a state like Texas. He will not want for money in the end because national money and third-party groups will be coming to his aid. It's unclear who his Democratic opponent is going to be right now. Cornyn is a well-known name, and frankly, he has not offended a whole variety of groups. So while there's not much intensity to support him, there's also not much intensity to defeat him, not like there is with the president.
John Cornyn's role in the Senate, he's Mitch McConnell's right-hand man. Can he be attached to Mitch McConnell, the Senate leader, who is probably the least popular senator in the nation?
I think that he is now joined at the hip with both McConnell and President Trump, which is surprising because, he has fallen in line with the president's line, but he did so reluctantly. Yes, he is. I think it'll be fairly easy to portray him as McConnell's hatchet man. He was majority whip in the leadership when we get into Supreme Court races, and most recently the refusal of Mitch McConnell to allow election protection legislation onto the floor of the Senate. And we'll be watching Senator Cornyn morph into Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
Everything depends on who's going to challenge John Cornyn, and there's a race for that.
That's exactly right. I think had Beto gotten into the race early, he would have been able to continue the momentum from his Cruz effort. But now that the emperor has no clothes, in some polls he doesn't even register in terms of Democrats for the presidential primary. Most folks are looking at M.J. Hager, who challenged Congressman John Carter in the last election, beat him in his home county of Williamson County, which is one of those formerly rock-ribbed Republican counties. She's a veteran, a war hero, and most importantly, she has a national fundraising list. She's raised a fair amount of money. She has run a race now, a political race, And there really is nothing that prepares you for running statewide as much as running, even if you lose. In fact, the only reason she lost was Fort Hood went strongly for John Carter, but he lost his own home county. She makes a compelling case, but there's also Senator Royce West, an African-American senator from Dallas, longtime senator. We can presume that African-Americans are going to be highly motivated in this this election just based on some of the rhetoric that's come out of Washington. There may be some wind at his back as a result of that. He's not otherwise widely known and doesn't have as compelling a story to tell, say, as M.J. Hager. And there's Chris Bell, former congressman from Houston, ran for governor at one point, but so far I've yet to see any real support coalesce for him. Most people think that Hager is the most likely candidate.
So there's also congressional seats that were pretty close in the last election, and the 21st Congressional District, which is shared between San Antonio, Austin, and the Texas Hill Country, almost went blue, but not quite. And now we see that Wendy Davis is coming down from her old stomping grounds of Fort Worth, and she's going to run for that seat.
And had a pretty significant fundraising first day, actually. And that is also one of those districts. Chip Roy, who is the incumbent, he's a first-term congressman, emulated Senator Cruz in his early days when he essentially ground business to a halt over fairly symbolic issues, made news but not particularly good news. And Wendy Davis, again, a seasoned candidate, hopefully one of the great flaws with her her gubernatorial campaign was that she lost control of her message early on. Perhaps she has learned from that. That district is sufficiently transitional now. It is winnable by a Democrat. I would think it's a swing district. Davis starts with actually more name ID than Chip Roy does. We should also mention, we had Congressman Olson has announced that he is retiring. There is some talk that Mike McCall, north of Austin all the way to Bryan College Station, may be thinking about retiring. Kenny Marchant up in the Dallas area is targeted by the Democrats this time, and he's in a transitional district. So we may see a wave of retirements that create open seats, which in this environment is creates a not only a lot of interest, but if Democrats do coalesce like they think they will, could change the congressional map pretty dramatically.
There's an interesting thing happening with the U.S. Census in Texas. The state government is not going to put any money into trying to have take part in the complete count of trying to make sure that everyone is counted, which is unusual.
Correct.
Seeing how Texas needs to make sure that the count is complete so it can get as many federal dollars possible for things like transportation, education, special programs like SNAP, things like that. You have to wonder, why would Texas not want to have a complete count? What are they thinking?
A large part of the growth in Texas population is a minority. It's not just Hispanic or South American. It's Asian, particularly with the immigration rhetoric of the last decade, most of these groups are trending Democratic. So Republicans are routinely accused of voter suppression when you create impediments to being counted in the census. It's actually voter suppression at the very beginning by reducing those numbers. Apparently, they are prepared to trade loss of influence and lack of congressional representation, lack of federal dollars, in exchange for potentially holding on to power a little bit longer.
Harvey Kronberg is the founding editor of The Quorum Report, a nonpartisan online newsletter that covers Texas politics. It's at quorumreport.com. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. The Voting Rights Act was a landmark piece of federal legislation that prohibited racial discrimination in voting. It was signed into law by President Lyndon Johnson on August 6, 1965, during the height of the Civil Rights Movement. and it gave federal government the authority to enforce voting protections in the South when Jim Crow, white supremacy, and acts of violence kept African Americans from voting. The Voting Rights Act is considered to be the most effective piece of federal civil rights legislation ever enacted in the United States, until 2013, when the Supreme Court struck down the coverage formula as unconstitutional. On Tuesday, the anniversary of the Voting Rights Act signing, events will be held across the nation to celebrate the passage and call for its full restoration. Michael Coleman is a spokesperson for Public Citizen Texas.
In 2013, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down the Shelby versus Holder ruling, and basically that gutted some key protections in the Voting Rights Act of 1965. The Voting Rights Act had given citizens and the government the right to challenge discriminatory laws in court, and it also required states with a history of discrimination to prove that new election laws wouldn't discriminate on the basis of race before those laws went into effect. That was called preclearance. It's a little bit technical, but basically the Shelby decision did away with that. And, you know, what we're trying to do on Tuesday nationwide and in at a rally in Austin and some other places in Texas is call attention to the fact that the Voting Rights Act is a landmark cornerstone of our democracy and that it's been under attack and that there's new legislation pending in Congress that would restore some of the stuff that the Supreme Court gutted.
The Supreme Court in its decision in Shelby County v. Holder kicked a lot back to the legislature. They're saying if you want to have these protections restored, that's up to you. And so how has the legislature responded?
Within 24 hours of this ruling, Texas announced its intent to pass the strictest voter ID law in the nation. Which it did. Texas is among 30 states nationwide that have adopted voter restrictions since this ruling.
But Congress in Washington, D.C., why haven't they passed the restoration of the Voting Rights Act?
Congress has been run by Republicans largely since then. We've had, I think that, generally they are reluctant to pass laws opening voting to people who have historically been disenfranchised. I think that there's a fear that, people of color and others who've been disenfranchised might tend to vote Democratic. And I think that there's been a resistance to passing laws to make it easier to vote and a proclivity towards passing laws that make it harder to vote.
So when the Voting Rights Act was first passed, Texas was not part of the states that was included in those protections. Later, it was folded in when it became clear that it was needed, particularly looking at suppression against Latino voters. And so how has that changed, bringing Texas into the 1965 Voting Rights Act, how has that changed things in Texas?
Well, as you alluded, there's been a long history of voter suppression in Texas going back decades and decades. They passed the Voting Rights Act in 1965. And then the year later, the U.S. Supreme Court found that the poll taxes in state elections violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, and Texas had been enacting poll taxes. So that was no longer allowed. And then in response to that, in 1966, the Texas legislature passed a law that required voters to register annually. So if you didn't re-register every year, you would show up to the polls, not be able to vote. And that annual voter registration requirement remained in effect in Texas until 1971. And then in 71, the 26th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States was passed that lowered the voting age to 18. And then at that time, the requirement for annual voter registration in Texas was removed.
When I talk about some of the issues in voting in Texas and some of the efforts to keep certain people from voting, a lot of people know about the poll tax. Not a lot of people know about the white primary system that was in place in Texas from 1923 to 1944, and it survived until Smith v. Allwright, a Supreme Court decision. But, you know, in Texas, you would have to, only white people were allowed to vote Democratic primary. To me, this is like a prime example of how there have been institutions in place who have been worked very hard to keep certain individuals from exercising their right to vote.
That you're right. And that's a perfect blatant example. You actually had to show up at the polls and state that I am white. Which today sounds completely outrageous. It was outrageous. You know, obviously we don't have to do that anymore, but there are there are other ways, you know, in more modern times that some lawmakers, public officials are working to keep people from voting for sure.
Yeah, things like limiting the time where early voting can take place in certain places. When we had pre-clearance in Texas, when the Voting Rights Act was in its full, robust state, if you moved polling places around, if you did anything unusual with the voting process, you would have to go through the Attorney General's office first, and they were
right.
And so the loss of pre-clearance allows county officials or state officials to do things with the voting process, which in a way limit certain populations from having access to the polls.
Many things, right. It could be anything from, you know, opening polls late to, malfunctioning voter machines, various forms of voter intimidation. SB 9, which was pending in the legislature this session and which fortunately died in the House late in the session. A lot of us were holding our breath about that one. That would have threatened voters with jail time and enormous fines in some cases for marking a ballot incorrectly. It would have weakened the right to provisional ballots, these ballots that are used to record a vote when there are questions about a voter's eligibility. So those need to be resolved before the vote can count. But, you know, it could weaken the right to have those if you show up and, there's a question about it. So it also made it harder for the elderly and people with disabilities to go to the polls. They had a strange requirement where people, you know, who took more than three folks to the polls had to jump through some hoops and, deal with some red tape. It gave partisan poll watchers the right to be in the voting booth when a volunteer was helping someone. It's a clear encroachment on the secret ballot. There were all kinds of things in that bad bill that ultimately died. But we the Public Citizen, the Texas Civil Rights Project, a lot of other groups fought really hard to bring that to light and let people know that there was bad news for Texas and Texas voters.
What is it that y'all want people to celebrate with the anniversary, the 54th anniversary of the signing of the Voting Rights Act? Why is that important to celebrate while there's all this negative stuff going on?
Well, I think it's important to celebrate because this is a landmark law that was passed 54 years ago that provided all Americans with the right to vote. And I think we want to, sort of hold that up as a beacon and say, in the time since, there have been numerous attempts to weaken this law, including this critical Supreme Court decision in 2013. And in Texas, we're unfortunately sort of at the vanguard of voter suppression and discrimination. And there are some very sneaky, underhanded tactics being implemented to suppress the right of Texans to vote. So at the same time we want to celebrate the Voting Rights Act, we want to call attention to the fact that voting rights are under attack in Texas.
Michael Coleman is a spokesperson for Public Citizen Texas. They will be holding a celebration and a vigil for the Voting Rights Act on Tuesday in Austin at the David Chapel Missionary Baptist Church. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page or on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can find past Texas Matters programs. And you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.